Hi, everybody, and welcome to Mecha Dragon, a podcast about all the geeky and nerdy stuff you love. Brought to you by Captain Geek and the Dark Nerd. I'm your Captain, Will.
And I'm your nerd, Jess.
Today, we're talking about Joker, the new 2019 movie with Joaquin Phoenix as the titular character. It's going to be a real interesting conversation today, and as you heard, we have nerd Jess back with us, but we're also very happy to have back with us Eric Hansen. Welcome back to the show, Eric.
Hello, it is a pleasure to be here.
So today we're talking about The Joker, and I thought this was a really interesting movie, but I would like just very briefly to start off with a non-spoilery discussion that only needs to go a few minutes for anybody who still hasn't seen the movie and is maybe, you know, trying to decide whether or not they want to go see it. So we'll just talk for a couple minutes in a non-spoilery way, and then we'll give you the spoiler warning and go into the spoilers. So let's actually start with the Dark Nerd's point of view on Joker. So what can you say in a non-spoiler way about Joker? Jess, go.
Let's see. I was really anticipating this movie when I first heard about it. And when Joaquin... what was your pronunciation of his name? Joaquin?
It's Joaquin. Isn't it Joaquin? What did I say? Did I say
Joaquin? You said Joaquin.
Yeah.
I'm the worst. I'm the worst.
That sounds like a monster from the Cthulhu myth,
though. Well, we're going to keep it because I love it because this is great.
It's totally Joaquin.
It's
Joaquin.
Thank you. My stepmom's name is Jacqueline, and you said Joaquin, and I was like, wait a second. Anyway, I love him as an actor. I think he's really talented and really versatile. And just from the first trailer of Joker, I was enthralled. I really enjoyed just the angle they took on it in this. It's a origin story, naturally, but it's completely different from anything we've seen so far in all of the other Batman and Joker reincarnations, or incarnations from the past, I should say. But his acting in this movie is stellar. I thought the film overall was fantastic. It's really dark, and there's been a lot of controversy about it. I think we'll get into that later on. Mm-hmm. And, of course, there's the ultimate Joker showdown, where everyone has their favorite Joker, and I'm sure that's something we'll get into
ultimate Joker
well.
Showdown. Yeah, interesting.
But as far as the movie, I need to see it again. It was fantastic. Even if you're not a fan, it's worth seeing.
Yeah, okay. Eric, what are your non-spoilery thoughts about this movie?
All right. Well, as you guys know, I may not be the biggest fan of the superhero genre as a whole, and you know, it's been interesting to sit back and watch DC struggle to try and match the success of Marvel. And I think it says a lot that this movie, which is one of the films where they didn't try to be Marvel, where they tried to do something completely different with the genre, has so far not only been their most, you know, critically successful, but also one of their most commercially successful films. Because this film, you know, it's right out of the 1970s, during that period of American cinema that was very cynical, very gritty, very dirty. And, you know, it really captures, you know, the feeling of movies like Taxi Driver. I mean, basically...
And it really seems like it's set in the 70s, too. It's a very 70s world that he's in.
Yeah, it's Taxi Driver with the Joker. That's the movie. And it doesn't have to be connected with Batman to be as good as it ultimately is. And honestly, like the Batman franchise was the furthest thing from my mind while watching it, because it's a character study of this man that's slowly losing it. You know, he gets pushed, you know, too far until eventually at the end he just cracks. And it's brilliant.
Those are some really interesting comments, Eric, and I tend to agree with you. You know, this is the kind of the way that I've been thinking about it is this movie, Joker, it's really a dark, gritty movie that in a way has more in common with like a Coen Brothers or Scorsese film than your typical superhero movie.
Right.
You know, if you're coming into this movie expecting spandex wearing superheroes or explosions or things like that, you're going to be disappointed. But if you like tonally dark, you know, psychological dramas, that's what this movie is. And, you know, Jess, you were saying about the performances were really fantastic. Yeah, I mean, Joaquin, actually generates some empathy for like one of the craziest, most nihilistic villains in at least comic book history.
Yeah. And I think one of the most interesting things is he's really not a villain at all in this entire movie. I mean, there's like one scene.
Are you kidding?
No, I mean, up until the end, it's like...
You have to remember, we're still talking non-spoilers here.
Up until the spoiler happens. But no, it's like, you see, it's not like he's like, all right, I'm going to burn this city to the ground. I'm going to go out and destroy everything. He's just a guy trying to get through his life. And it keeps beating him down physically, literally, emotionally. You know, he's just getting beat down from all angles. And yeah, it changes him. And it is a downward spiral. And
well, I would like to get further into this concept once we get into the spoiler part, because I don't think I can really discuss it without talking about specifics of like things that happen in the movie.
Correct.
You know, things that happen to him.
I haven't been doing this podcast thing for like a month and a half.
But
I'm
suffice
a little rusty.
It to yeah, well, that's, you know,
like
to be expected
virgin.
From an old fogey like you. But no, seriously, I disagree with what you're saying. I do think that they managed to create a surprising level of empathy for Joker in this movie. At least it was surprising to me. But I do think that he definitely became a villain by the end. So,
oh, yeah,
with that
became
said,
is one thing, but it's not like, you know, it's
yeah,
not
we'll,
like
we'll
was,
get into it. We'll get into it.
It's
So where we're at, though, like when you're thinking about this movie, let's start with Eric this time. How many maniacal laughs out of 10 do you give this movie overall?
Well, let's see. Objectively, is this one of my favorite movies of the year? Not so far. But can I objectively say it's not one of the best movies of the year? No, I can't say that because that would be full of crap. It's one of the best movies of the year. Like for me personally, on an entertainment level, I would give it 8 out of 10.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as, you know, how good is the film objectively, how many risks does it take with the genre? You know, I would have to give it like at least a 9.5, but maybe a perfect 10.
Interesting. Interesting. What about you, Jess? What do you give it?
I'm glad you said that, Eric. I was pre-podcast. I was like, how am I going to, because I look at this movie in two different ways. How am I going to rate it? And I totally agree. Overall, I'm going to give it an 8.5. But as for like Joaquin's performance and the delivery of the movie and just, I don't know, it's just the feel of the movie itself. Overall, like you said, is it your favorite? Possibly not. Is it fantastic? Yes. Even though it may not be what you're looking for and what you're into, it's still executed near flawlessly, I think. And it's such a great twist on something that we've all grown up, you know, with some familiarity to. So, yeah, I'd give it an 8.5 overall. But I think as far as performance and stuff, it's definitely 9.5 to a 10.
Interesting.
It's just a really striking, you know, movie.
I find it interesting how you're kind of separating the ratings into like one for, you know, entertainment value for me personally versus maybe like a more objective reading of the film.
Well, this is a weird movie. I mean, it's just been from the get-go, just kind of the delivery itself has been not your average movie, and it's really not. But it's just like, yeah, it was a fantastic movie, and I don't know. It's
well,
it's
for
hard.
Me, you know, I think that my personal rating, if I'm going to follow the same sort of template as you guys, like for personal entertainment value, I think for me it hit me at about an 8, which is pretty good. I mean, that's, you know, it's an 8 out of 10. But if I was to take a step back and say, okay, you know, based on execution of the script itself, the performances, you know, all the themes and, you know, everything taken together, maybe more objectively, I would give it maybe a 9. I don't think it goes above that for me because I think that, you know, maybe it's kind of hard to like sit here and think, well, maybe they could have gone further if you really think about the events of the movie. But it's, I think for me at least, it's hard to come out of a psychological drama that's this dark with this much violence and with the way that the ending makes you feel and say, oh, that was a 10. I can't do that. That's not, I mean, when you get down to it, any analysis that you have of any piece of art, I think when you get down to it fundamentally is going to be subjective. So I hesitate to say, you know, that there is an objective stance you can take on this movie. But I think that we are all in agreement this is a pretty exceptional movie and right. Definitely a real standout in the realm of comic book movies. Would that be fair to say? Would you guys agree with
oh,
that?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. It's funny how it's like you said, you can't give it a higher rating due to the violence and stuff, but that made me think, like, how exactly did the movie make you feel?
Well, we're going to get into that because I want, in the spoiler section, because I really want to be specific in why it, you know, made me feel a certain way. Gotcha. and all of that. So, yeah, so with all of that said, are there any final non-spoilery thoughts you want to share before we go into the spoiler section? I think we're about due for that.
Does the fact that Iron Man dies, is that a spoiler still?
Ding, 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 ding.
Oh, okay. That would be, well, a spoiler. Iron Man dies at the 45-minute mark in this movie for all of those people who have not yet watched.
Right. Because that makes sense.
9 months ago.
okay. Well, with all that said, let's move on to the spoiler section of the podcast. So let's get into it, guys.
Okay. How'd your kids? How'd your wife?
Let me start off with a question for you guys, okay? Mm-hmm. And let's go with Eric first, and then I want to get Jess's reaction to this before I add in. So, do you consider this an origin story for the Joker, and why or why not? And as an origin story, do you think it was effective? Or if you don't think it was an origin story, was it effective in some other way?
Well, let's see. The Joker has several different backstories based on whatever iteration you're looking at. I consider this to be, well, so far it's more of a standalone movie. It's certainly not an origin story for the Joker from the Christopher Nolan movies, nor from the comics. It's more of a nitty-gritty kind of real-world look at a man slowly going insane. And it's funny because the whole movie, I never saw the Joker, I only saw Arthur.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
To me, it's less about, you know, the makeup and more about the guy underneath.
Definitely.
So, I mean, is it an origin story for the Joker? Absolutely. But only this iteration. It's not the Joker from every comic ever written, because those are from a totally different world from what the kind of world we see here.
Interesting. And so do you think that as an origin story, right, this origin, how effective would you say it is as an origin? And I know that I agree with all the comments you just said, but in terms of, in the context of this as an origin for a character that ends up calling himself Joker, right? How effective do you think it is, and what do you think the strongest part of it is in the film?
Well, I think it is an effective origin story because it's an effective character arc. You know, you see a guy who's very repressed, very beaten down, and he's unwilling to stand up for himself. And he should stand up for himself, but he takes it way too far. Like, he overcorrects, if you will, until he gets into an extreme that's, you know, equally unhealthy to where he goes at the start of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the second part of your question?
What do you think was the... what was it in the film that, for you, made it a really effective origin for this character?
Well,
I mean, it's kind of a broad question.
I think I just summed that up.
I think you did, totally. So Jess, how would you respond to this?
It's totally an origin story. And the thing I took out of it overall was, not only is it an origin story, like you mentioned earlier, it's not a superhero spandex type of movie, but it's 2019. This movie took place in the 80s.
It doesn't really say, but it felt more like the 70s to me.
Yeah, maybe early 80s, late 70s. There's still a couple of things going on with the designs of the movie that are a little 70s-ish. But In 2019 America, today, right now, if you and me and Eric turned on the news and saw some guy who called himself Joker, this could be his origin. This is a real life. This is...
You're saying it... I think what you're saying is it feels really realistic.
It feels like something that could literally happen. This could be something that creates a Joker in a real world setting. And I think a lot of people connected with that. And that's why a lot of people really were disturbed by this film, because it does have so much realism. And there's the mental illnesses and stuff that are displayed in it. It's like, this is something that could happen two blocks away. You know, this is some guy trying to live his life Monday through Friday, hoping for a weekend off, and just getting beat down at every turn. And I can understand how that can drive someone to this.
I want to come back to what you're saying in a different part of the podcast, because I find it really interesting how the story of this movie holds a mirror up in some ways to society today. I mean, a lot of movies do that, but it seems a little extra pronounced in this one.
Yeah, this one did it really well. And it's funny how they took the setting of the 80s / 70s. I mean, how many years ago is that? That's like 6 years ago, right? No, wait. 1990 wasn't 10 years ago. We're talking about 30, 40 years ago. And it feels so relevant today, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's another reason this movie is just so, I don't know, the word, transcendent.
Compelling.
Compelling. There's a lot of, it's a crazy movie. I like it.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll get into that in a minute. But just, I'll just comment real quickly on my thoughts on this as an origin story for the Joker. You know, going into this movie, I had mixed feelings about it. My concern was that the movie would give the Joker character a really definitive origin, when I think that him having like a mysterious or ambiguous origin is one of the things that helps make the character so powerful. I mean, he's like chaos and nihilism personified. I mean, among the many ways that Joker can be frightening, he's scary in a way that I feel like something like the alien from the Alien movies is, in a way. I mean, he's unpredictable. Yeah.
Exactly.
So in that sense, a definitive origin to me would allow you to classify him in a way that makes him more knowable and less scary and easier to explain away. And so I was hoping that the movie wouldn't fall into that kind of trap, but I don't think that it did.
No.
In fact, and this is something that I really want to get your guys' thoughts on, there is very little in that movie that I think you can say definitely actually happened to him. I mean, there are only a couple scenes in that movie that I think you can say definitely happened, and those are basically when he snaps out of his like daydreamings or delusions. Like, there was the scene where he's kind of daydreaming that he's on that talk show and Murray like gives him a hug and is like a father figure, and then he like snaps out of it. And then later you find out that, you know, his whole relationship with Zazie Beetz's character, you know, the girl next door, was just a delusion, right? That didn't happen. And
that
so
was the
I
incredibly
think,
attractive lady that he dated, right?
Well, I remember thinking when that scene where she comes to his door and she's like, "Hey, you were following me yesterday, weren't you?" And he's like, "Yeah." And she's like, "Do you want to go on a date?" And I was like, "Wait a minute, that is suspect. That would not happen." And then later, of course, it shows that he was just hallucinating or under this delusion the whole time. And I thought,
"That's
okay,
another
well, that
reason
makes sense.
I got to watch this movie again, because it is something
but then,
that
so at the very
your mind
end."
In a loop.
He's back in Arkham, I think, right? And he's talking to that his caseworker or whoever that woman was in him, and he kind of laughs, and he says, and she asks him what he's laughing at, and he says, "You wouldn't get it." And it's so I think that it's quite possible. You could definitely read this movie in a way that says everything almost everything that we just watched was a story that he told that woman, and maybe he was always in Arkham.
Is this something like The Sixth Sense, where they use the color red, and every time the color red is prominent, that means that it's a... I can't remember the word.
I didn't see any type of like signaling that would say this scene is definitely a delusion. This scene
I've heard all the arguments yellow. About oh well, none of this happened and it was all made up and his mom blah 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 and this blah 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 and his dad blah.
Well,
blah,
see,
blah. I don't know. That's why I got to watch it again, because it leaves so many questions unanswered.
It does. Well, you know, Arthur Fleck, Joker in this movie, he is very. He's a very unreliable narrator.
Oh, absolutely. Right?
The movie is definitely from his point of view, and he's a very unreliable narrator. So I have explained what my thoughts are on this, and let's start with you piped in a couple comments, Jess, so I want to get Eric's reaction to this theory and then go back to you.
I think it's a very plausible theory. It's a very interesting way to read the film as, you know, maybe, you know, this character is having a revenge fantasy. Mm-hmm. You know, while he's locked up in the walls of Arkham, or you could, you know, have it be like, oh, this whole thing is what gets him into Arkham. I think both are equally plausible, because we have seen in the movie that large swaths of the film didn't happen, like the bit with the girl, you know, with his neighbor, you know, that didn't happen. It was just a fantasy. So maybe the whole movie's a fantasy. I think it's an interesting way to look at it.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that I think that everything was, a delusion or a story except for the part at the end. But I think it's possible, you know, I really do. And, you know, the director, Todd Phillips, who co-wrote it and directed it, has said that that laugh at the end there when he tells his caseworker that she wouldn't get the joke is his most genuine laugh of the movie. And that kind of stuck with me. And I just find it fascinating that... So to bring this full circle, the idea is it doesn't give him a definitive origin. It actually gives him a very ambiguous origin underneath the series of events that may or may not have happened. And I think that that's totally appropriate for the Joker. And I think that that really plays to what's always made the Joker a really compelling character. So, did you have any further thoughts on this theory or this reading of it, Jess?
I certainly do. I read one theory where it's like that scene where he's in the mirror and he's putting on his makeup and the blue looks like tears, and then he puts his fingers and he hooks his mouth. Mm-hmm. And I heard that one of the theories is everything after that was fantasy.
It could be.
That's one way to look at it.
And there's a lot. There are some weird details in the movie that I have not seen a great theory on so far. Like, for example, pretty much any time you see a clock in the movie, it's at 11:11.
Oh, I did not know.
Every time. So next time you watch the movie, just watch. Yeah. You know, everything from a clock on the wall to in his house to his, you know, where he punches his card in at work to like on the TV and stuff.
It's synchronicity.
Well, it's interesting. There's some theories behind it. I'm not going to get into any of them right now because I haven't seen one that's really been that convincing to me. And the filmmakers have refuse to confirm any fan theories at this point, which I actually like, because I think that fosters more of a conversation about it. And I also don't think that, I mean, this is more of an academic perspective, but I don't necessarily think, you know, the creator's intention is necessarily the most definitive reading of a piece of art. And that's a whole different conversation.
Kind of speaking on that, I listened to a bunch of podcasts today, and what I'm going to do is quote one of them without quoting the source or any other information, because that's how I roll, because I forgot, because I was at work and was kind of half paying attention. But I did hear that Todd Phillips, the director, and Joaquin Yequelin, whatever you want to call him,
don't try and copy my mispronunciation.
They never actually had a conversation about what was real and what wasn't. You know what I mean? It's like they never sat down and said, we're going to record, or we're going to film today a scene that it's from your memory, or we're going to record today.
Well, that's not surprising to me. That doesn't surprise me at all.
Well, yeah, but it's just like they never actually went into it filming it even from the beginning on the studio floor of it being a certain time in the movie, well, fake or real. So it's hard to determine while watching the film what's fake or real. And I think when I watched the movie originally, I never once thought any of it was fake until he walked into Zazie Beetz's, I can't remember her name in the movie, into her apartment, sitting on the couch. She walked in and said, "What are you doing here?" You know, right. I never thought that it was imagined or, you know, any of that. So that was a twist in the movie for me. Mm. And now that I've only seen it once, looking back on the movie, it's like, oh, what else did I miss? Because there could be so much.
Yeah. I mean, I think it would be totally normal for the filmmaking team to get together on set and be like, all right, let's do this, without coordinating as to like, okay, well, this part's really real and this part is fake. And like, but I have to imagine that while they were writing the script, they had their own intention of what was real, you know, and to what extent he was just delusional. But I'm really glad that they don't come out and like shut down fan theories and conversations by saying, no, definitively, according to me, this is what's really real. And that's one of the fun things about talking about movies, I think. So I'm really glad they went that direction with it. Okay, so with that said, I do want to get into kind of what you were talking about a minute ago, Jess, which is the movie's themes. Mm-hmm. So why don't we actually start with you again, Jess? So talk a little bit more about how, like, what you were talking about in terms of the movie being very topical and mirroring things that are going on today. I don't want to get real political, but like, if we could just talk in general about how it's kind of showing us these things about society, and like, also, and this is also the question I'm going to ask Eric, what is your sense of the movie's themes? How did those impact you? And what do you think the broader impact is on audiences in general?
Well, I think, you know, it kind of started, I was watching, or no, Edward Norton has a new movie coming out. I can't remember what it's called, but he's on podcasts everywhere. So what keeps coming up in these podcasts is the movie Primal Fear, which is a psychological thriller. And I don't know why that just popped in my mind, but this movie is kind of, it's tackling mental illness in the same way that movie tackled whatever it tackled back in the day. Was it like priest raping kids? I don't know. Because that really happened. But this movie tackles a lot of stuff that's, it's like I mentioned earlier, it's 2019 and everyone is super sensitive about pretty much everything that you can assign a word to define it as. And just watching this and seeing an accurate portrayal, like I said, this is something that I feel could happen today in society. This could be something that really happens to a person and turn them into
the Joker.
So are
you saying that you feel like the movie is exploring a social situation that is very timely to the present day?
Oh, I do think it's very timely because there's a lot of stuff going on in the world today where everyone is becoming not more knowledgeable. It's just like when you and I were growing up, we didn't learn about anything until basically it was on the news or our parents talked about it. Now, something can happen on the other side of the planet and you hear about it instantly. So people are learning about things more quickly than they did in the past. And mental illness, sexuality, all the stuff, politics, without going into politics, it's just hammering you left and right and left and right. So I think people are becoming more aware of the fact that there is mental illness in the world, and this movie really kind of puts it on the forefront. And with the whole issue of the U.S. Army issuing warnings against people going to see this movie because of the possibility that it might become a mass shooting, that is ridiculous.
So to be clear, though, this so those warnings that you mentioned, I mean, that wasn't just because somebody in the government watched, you know, a screener of the movie and was like, oh, well, we got to be careful for people like breaking out into spontaneous violence in the movie theater. No, there were credible threats that they picked up on. And, you know, these groups that were threatening to perform these acts of violence had glommed onto this movie for whatever reason in their twisted minds and said, well, this would be a good opportunity for us to do violence. But
I think the reason they glommed onto it is because of the Colorado shooting at the Batman movie. You know? No one's like, I fucking hate Spider-Man. I'm going to kill everyone who loves Spider-Man. For some reason, it's Batman and the Joker. And I agree that DC is not as good at making movies as Marvel, but I don't want to kill them for it. I mean, maybe a good spanking, a good hard talking to. Maybe bust a tooth or three.
So, Eric, what's your sense of the movie's themes? How did those themes impact you, and what do you think the broader impact is on the audiences?
To me, this movie was about the revenge on the haves by the have-nots.
Yeah.
That was the movie to me. It was, you know, the lower class taking revenge on the upper class. And I mean, it's a theme that's always really interested me. I mean, one of my favorite Wes Craven films, People Under the Stairs, has that theme, although the protagonist in that is a bit more stable. It touched on a lot of things that, you know, I'm really passionate about, you know, things that are not going terribly well in the world today. And, you know, kind of really summed up a feeling of, you know, frustration, desire to revolt, you know, all those kinds of things that I think made Arthur a very identifiable character, even as he slowly lost his goddamn mind. I think the dangers posed in the film, you know, it's basically like, you know what, don't go too far. Do not take it too far or it's lost. That was kind of what I took away from it, was somebody who was a lot less fortunate than me and had a lot more legitimate grievances than me and had every right to kind of take a stand for himself. But he takes that stand and he goes way too far with it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really interesting take on it that I don't really disagree with. I came away from the movie with a sense that it wanted to explore how mental illness and social illness, if you want to put it that way, feed on each other until both individuals and groups reach a breaking point. And that it wanted to explore those ideas specifically without like a hero figure, right? Mm-hmm. And frankly, it almost seems like everyone in this film, just about everyone, acts like a villain at some point. I mean, Joker murders people, he foments violence. He's a stalker. Murray, the De Niro's character, the talk show host, humiliates Arthur in his comedy act. He brings him on the show for further public humiliation, like just to get some laughs. Arthur's mother abused him, let others abuse him, and maybe probably lied to him about stuff for many years. Arthur's co-workers and random people he meets are generally cruel to him. I mean, even Thomas Wayne, Bruce Wayne's father in this movie, is cold, uncompassionate, elitist, out of touch, you know, with the common people, condescending. This is a world without heroes. And I found that to be fascinating. And two, some general points that you guys have made, both of you guys. One of the fascinating things to me is how this movie struck a nerve in other countries, even much more so than here in the United States. So there's a great article in Slate about how the movie came out right before this enormous, massive, like, protests and riots that had been going on in Chile, and how people took events in the movie as kind of symbolic for what's been happening in their country. And, you know, I don't want to get into, like, all the details of, like, protests in Chile, but I mean, it was so massive. And in this article, you see pictures of people dressed up in the makeup and everything as the Joker, because it's really been, you know, taken symbolically as this central figure that expresses the frustrations that people have with society. And,
It's the Guy Fawkes mask of 2019.
Well, I would say those things represent really quite different things, you know, but that's a whole different kind of political discussion. But I mean, I just find it fascinating how this movie has struck a nerve. And so on one hand, you have certain, you know, crazy groups out there thinking this is an opportunity to do violence. And then you have people in other countries saying this expresses the frustration that we feel. And so we're going to take on some of the images from it as a symbol that maybe means something a little bit different to them than it does, you know, in the movie or to us in the United States. And so, yeah, even though, you know, I don't personally give this movie a 10, I do find it fascinating how deeply it has resonated to people all over the place.
It was so weird because this movie was hated before it was released. You know, the media and the hype surrounding it, it's like people are warning against seeing it. It's like, watch out for razor blades in the apples your kids get for Halloween because it's the Joker movie.
I think anytime you have a movie that has, you know, realistic depictions of violence and a darker tone, you get those type of complaints. But I would not say that this movie glorifies any of that. What do you think about that, Eric?
I think the problem people have with it is that the violence actually made them uncomfortable. And my stance is good.
Yeah.
This isn't play violence. This isn't cowboys and Indians. You know, the violence is real. It is ugly. It is visceral and nasty.
And it's not violence for the sake of violence either. How many will? You just watched Terminator Dark Fate. How many people died in that movie?
I'm not sure, but I mean, a lot.
More than seven?
Yeah, I would think so, yeah.
Okay, well, guess how many people died in Joker? Seven. There's not a lot of... I mean, okay, violence. The clown got beat by a bunch of punks on the street in New York. That shit happens
every day. I think what Eric said is right, is that the violence makes people uncomfortable.
It does make
it uncomfortable. And it is a very realistic depiction of violence, and... Right. It's not casting things in a very black or white sort of depiction of it, right? It's not fun action movie violence. It's like these people have serious mental problems. There are serious.
It's not Hulk grabbing Loki by his ankles and slamming his face into the floor, cracking marble tiles.
It's real people with real grievances performing very disturbing violence on each other, and that does make you uncomfortable. But to Eric's point, I think that's good.
It's crazy, though, that it's happening in 2019, where everyone is so concerned with what's happening on the street, on the corner, just next door. Everyone wants to know what's happening in the world because it's going to affect them, and this is a portrayal of what's actually happening in the world, and they don't want any part of it. You know what I mean? And that's why, like Eric said, it's violence not for the sake of violence, but it's violence on a level that kind of coincides with my approach to what this movie's trying to portray, is that this is a realistic display of what can create a supervillain or a villain like Joker, because it is all realistic and it is uncomfortable and it makes us fear and question. And when you walk out of the movie theater, you don't really know what you feel. And that's why everyone needs to see this movie.
In other words, it is an intimate psychological drama that portrays a man's descent into madness. Essentially. Exactly. I mean, you could put it that way. So that's really interesting thematic discussion. Before I move on to other thoughts that I had, Eric, were there any particular topics that you wanted to make sure that we brought up and talked about here?
Well, I think this movie, I mentioned earlier, this movie definitely takes a cue from a lot of, you know, the nitty-gritty thrillers of the early 70s, because the early 70s were a very cynical age in the United States, and they bred a lot of films like Death Wish, you know, Taxi Driver, Dog Day Afternoon, what have you. And I think we're kind of in a similarly cynical age with you know, in America today. And I think I think Joker is definitely a product of that cynicism. But there are also a lot of echoes of those earlier films. Like, not only did you cast, you know, De Niro in this movie as a nod to both Taxi Driver and the King of Comedy, but once again, you have a scene of your lead character who is unhinged shooting a bunch of people on the subway, which is a scene that's right out of the original Death Wish. But I would like to point out how the sequence has changed. Because in the original Death Wish with Charles Bronson, which incidentally isn't that good a movie, but we'll get – that's a discussion for another day. Bronson kills a couple of muggers on the subway, and they are, you know, they're people of color. They're obviously, you know, down on their luck economically, and they're portrayed of as, you know, these grungy, grimy, horrible creatures. But in Joker – who are the people he kills on the subway? It's white guys in polyester suits, because they're the villains of today's world. And I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, I think that they actually called – in the movie, they called them Wall Street guys, didn't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they did. They did. And how, like, everybody's, like, saying, oh, you know, these fine young men, it's such a tragedy. And you see them acting like bastards on this subway.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it really resonates at the end when Joker is on Murray's show, right?
All right.
And he finally, you know, he admits on air to killing these guys, and he says, what does he say? He says something like, you know, why you guys keep talking about these Wall Street guys like they're such great people. Why are you so concerned about their deaths? If you would have seen me dead on the sidewalk, you would have just stepped over me without noticing me. And I think that's a statement that I felt like it really resonated in the movie theater when I was in there. I felt that everybody was really into that moment and really picking up what he was saying. And it feels like from a lot of the commentary and things that I've read about the movie that that's echoing a sentiment that is out there and is a reflection of our times.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I'm going to say this. I think he was justified in shooting the first two guys because they were beating him. It's the third guy. The third guy is the one I can't excuse.
The one that was running away?
Yeah, the first two you can say, okay, he is defending himself. The third guy, it's like, I need to get rid of a witness.
Yes, but again, absolutely.
It's again, a display of, you know, what's going on in the movie where, you know, he takes it too far.
Okay, well, here's my counterpoint to that, which I'm going to echo the good captain here when he says, in response to my argument of how come these people do these stupid things, how come they don't fight back, how come they don't do this, how come they don't do that, and his response is always, when you're under incredible stress, you act out in ways that really aren't predictable and perhaps not something you would agree with. So maybe it was just him in the stress of the moment, hyped up on adrenaline, fighting back, getting revenge. He bam bam shot the first two guys, and then he wants to get the other fucking guy, so he chases him down and kills him too, not because he's trying to kill a witness, just because he's so in the moment and he needs to kill that guy. And
he was under, but that doesn't
stress.
But that,
you definitely
mean
picked
that
up in the performance. He's wigged out of his mind in that scene.
That's true. And I know which comments of mine you're referring to. For example, like when Star-Lord, you know, punches Thanos and everybody's like, you're stupid. But so, A, yes, he was very emotional in that moment. It was an emotional decision. But that doesn't mean he didn't go too far.
He earned that emotion because he was literally fighting for his life.
Well, sure. But again, that doesn't mean that he didn't take it too far. And of course, he went on after that to like kill more people, including his own mother. Right. So he obviously took it too far. But I think that one of the powerful things about this movie is how it shows how things can sort of spiral out of control until you reach a breaking point. And the breaking point is where things start to go too far.
Yeah. And that's another thing, too, why this is so realistic, because it's not like there's aliens coming out of wormholes in the sky in this movie, and there's, you know, titans from other planets that are coming to destroy stuff, and you have to gather your wits about you and fight. This is normal, everyday stuff. People get beat on the subway all the time. People have crappy jobs. People are abandoned by their fathers. And, you know, this is all stuff that happens today.
It's gritty.
And that's why it's so believable that this Joaquin in this role this character could become a Joker. And it's so compelling to imagine if they took this approach. Like, I really don't think we're ever going to see Joaquin Phoenix standing next to Jason Momoa and Gal Gadot, you know, fighting them or whatever in the DC universe, because...
Well, they've said that they're definitely not going to be crossing into, like, Batman movies and things
right,
like that.
Right, but I mean, could you take this approach to any other of the quote-unquote superheroes in the world?
Well, it's stylistically and tonally even so different from any of the other, like, DC comic book movies that I'd be really surprised if they tried to, you know, make this a part of their DCEU. But this is the part of the conversation where I wanted to come back to something you said initially, Jess, was that you didn't think that Arthur Fleck or Joker was ever a villain in this movie. And I have to disagree, because I think that the moment that he kills that third Wall Street guy, he does become a villain. Now, maybe you could say that, oh, you know, he doesn't necessarily become a villain there because he still has opportunity to change and do something right or redeem himself somehow. But he never does that. And he goes on to kill his own mother.
True.
Kill the host of the most popular, like, city's, like, talk show live
on live TV.
You know, and...
Well, right,
and
but
all
that
of,
was...
And all of
what
this
I'm
stuff.
Saying is he did become a villain. But it's not like he... It's not like that was his drive. It's not like that was his focus. That was not his... destination that he had planned. You
no,
know what I mean? It's like situationally he was kind of put into this bottleneck where he was pointed towards the only real solution that he had at the time, and he already had the mental things.
Yeah, that, like, Jess didn't say that he was never a villain. It's just that he becomes one undisputably by the end.
Yeah, but it's not like he became one because he wanted to be. It's
yeah,
not like
yeah,
he
I
woke
agree with
up saying,
yeah.
Wow, I'm going to destroy the world today. He didn't want to do that. He's like, I just want to get through today. And we all do that. I've had some issues. I'm not going to say I'm going to, you know, kill my mom with a pillow.
I got yelled at by my first customer today, and yes, he was a boomer.
but yeah, it's boomer. like Thanos... At one point in time said, I'm going to murder half of everything on purpose. And that became his goal. That became where he wanted to go. That never happened with the Joker. He woke up. I don't know.
Well, this is a really interesting topic for me because, you know, when you think about what a villain is and the word villain, it's like this is a role, an archetype that we've ascribed to, you know, the bad guys in stories. But when you break it down in real life, and we've talked so much about how this movie is so gritty and realistic, everybody thinks they're the good guy.
Right.
I mean, I'm sure that, like, you know, Hitler thought he was the good guy. Everybody thinks they're a good guy. Nobody says to themselves, I'm going to be a villain and become evil. No, it just, you know, things happen and they make decisions. And then it turns out, you know, in some cases that people do evil, villainous things.
Yeah. Everyone rages against the machine, but they never view the machine as the good guy, you know?
Yeah, like there are very few people in the world who know that they're evil and relish in it. And, you know, I think Arthur in this movie, you know, kind of fancied himself a victim. And the thing is, he is a victim. He's been victimized by every single person in this movie. He does not have a mm-hmm. single friend in mm-hmm. the entire film. His own mother has victimized him in one of the worst possible ways she could have done. Like taking him into a bad home and allowing him to be abused while taking... shelter in her own delusions. I mean, that's a horrible thing to do to a child. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I can really understand the betrayal he felt. And I could certainly understand him wanting to remove his mother from her life, although I wouldn't have done it with cotton wool. So,
right.
Well, yeah, and it's like you said, no one ever really looks at themselves as the villain. And in this case, it's like Arthur Fleck is not even looking at himself as the good guy. He doesn't really look at it from good versus evil. He's just a dude fighting back against the aggressors in his life. And yeah, he's got the mental issues and stuff, and it turned him towards a darker, an alleyway, if you will. But it's not like he ever really, what I got from the movie, at least, they didn't really portray it as him actually ever coming to terms with and accepting the dark side. It was just like, this is how I'm going to react, like kind of a knee-jerk reaction to things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I honestly think he...
killing his mom with a pillow.
He was probably planning on killing himself, you know, on De Niro's show, yeah. And the decision to shoot and kill De Niro was a spur of the moment decision.
Yeah, it's like he just reacted because he got angry, you know?
Yeah.
I think it was all... It's more reactionary, you know?
Well, because you see him rehearsing to committing suicide because he's planning to kill himself on air because he thinks it's the one time people are going to remember him and maybe even feel some pity for him to say, look, I'm suffering and now all of you tuning in get to see it forever. Like, I think that's – it was his one, you know, final desperate cry for help, you know, to maybe have people wonder, you know, what, maybe if we were nicer to this guy, maybe if we noticed him, we could have helped him. And then – he ends up, you know, coming unglued on that, you know, on that show. And then finally comes to say, you know, you're one more person that victimized me. You think I'm funny. You think my hard work is funny. You think my
lack of
success
me.
Is funny. No, you're not laughing with me. You're laughing at me. And, you know, it's and again, sense of betrayal, because earlier in the movie, during one of his dream sequences, you see that he viewed De Niro's character as this kind of ideal father figure, and it's just one more parental figure that's betrayed him at the end.
Yeah, and to your point, Eric, you know, I agree that he made that decision very much on the spot to shoot Murray instead of himself, but to me, that's the moment when he becomes truly Joker. Because, you know, he did a bunch of horrible stuff, you know, previous to that, but I think that there was something about that moment and the fact that he made that type of decision just in the moment and he ended up killing that guy. To me, that was the moment when he fully became, you know, this persona of Joker.
And that's interesting too, because it's like it happened and he really had no reaction. And even when the cops swarmed him and arrested him moments later, he didn't fight back. You know, it's not like he's like, you'll never take me alive. It's just like, he just got swarmed by the guys and arrested. And then it wasn't till later when the city, after viewing the live taping of the show and watching him kill Murray, and he became kind of a hero or an anti-hero.
He became a figurehead for the rioters, I would say.
And then, of course, you have the accident and they pull him out of the wreckage and, you know, he's bashed up and he's bleeding and stuff. And I think that was one of the most iconic scenes from the movie, when he stands there and he puts his fingers in his mouth with the blood and, you know, makes the little Joker smile on his face. And that, I mean, I got chills from that.
A really important distinction I want to make when we're talking about, you know, the specifics of this story is, like, look, he as Eric said, he is this victim and he's been victimized in all these different ways, and almost everybody in his life that he does know is cruel to him or has deceived him or abused him in some way. But, like, and that's sort of what brings him to this breaking point, right? And then he kills the Wall Street guys. And, of course, this... like, movement sort of grows up out of the social conflicts of the time, but with that as kind of like, you know, the straw that breaks the camel's back, and then people are in the streets. But when he becomes their, like, leader or figurehead, you know, in that iconic moment that you're talking about, he doesn't take on that mantle of the violent mob or protesters and all these other people that are dissatisfied as a way to, like, advance their cause or work against, you know, the ways in which they're oppressed or whatever it is.
No, but exactly, he does, because no, no, wait, the wait. Joker,
but he does it for recognition and the adulation that they shower on him. And to me, this is very emblematic of things that have happened so many times with, you know, different demagogues and stuff. And it's like they come out and they sort of grasp onto, you know, dissatisfaction in society, but they're doing it really for their own purposes. I'm not pointing a finger at anybody in particular because I don't want to talk specifics of, you know, politics today, but like I'm just saying that historically this is something that happens, and I think that it's important to make that distinction when you're talking about him and this like movement of people or these rioters or whatever it is.
Okay, okay, I think the distinction between Joker and a lot of demagogues like that is a lot of them latch on to those issues, but they're from the outside looking in.
Yes.
Whereas Arthur is actually there. He's actually suffering with them.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, I don't think it's so much wanting, you know, recognition. I think it's more he's just elated that he feels accepted.
Yes.
And, you know, and welcomed by this group that he has he has this, you know, kind of sense of belonging and purpose
that he never had before.
This thing happened.
Yeah, I agree with that. At the same time, it's like he does feel like he's accepted, but Will, you mentioned that he didn't accept the mantle of the crowd and the protesters, and he never, I can't remember exactly how he said, he never really fought for what they wanted. That's not the Joker. The Joker has never given a good goddamn about what anybody else wants or thinks. The Joker is very internal. He thinks only about himself. And it's not about other people. No one follows the Joker
because he's saying,
follow me and I will lead us this way. The Joker's like, this is what I'm doing. And people are like, hell yeah. You know, and that's the thing. It's like he never really wanted people to follow him. And it got to the point where you say he became the Joker when he shot Murray on television. But I think he became the Joker after he was pulled out of the car and he stood there. And he looked around upon the sea of faces all looking at him. And that's when he realized he wasn't alone in this world. Because the whole movie, he had no one. He imagined, you know, his life. He had no one. And he stood up on the car and suddenly he's surrounded and elevated above this crowd of people. All looking to him for guidance. And he does not step forward and say, I will be your leader. He just sticks his fingers in his mouth, draws the blood on his face, and says, this is who I am. And that's why that scene in the movie just hit me. And that's when he became the Joker, because he realized he wasn't alone. And from that, he's going to gain power. And he's still doing himself. He's not doing it for anyone else. No incarnation of the Joker ever has. So I think that was kind of the perfect embodiment of the Joker character in this movie.
So where do you come down on this, Eric? Where do you think he fully is self-realized as Joker?
I would agree with Jess. The moment he puts that blood on his face and, you know, because before then, you know, I think the fact that he uses blood does have some nice symbolism to it, because before then he's using, you know, the typical stuff like face paint. And at this point he's like, no, I'm going to paint myself with my own blood. I'm going to paint myself with my own wounds. I'm going to put...
Well, he changes the way he approaches himself in that moment, you know?
Yeah. And you know, even the idea of using blood, that goes against the mold. So it's kind of like that's the point that he embraces and celebrates the chaos around him that he has created.
Yeah, that is a really, really good point. And to be totally honest, I had forgotten that he, in that moment, took his blood and painted his face with it. Because I saw the movie when it first came out, and it's been a couple weeks now, or a few weeks. So that is a really great point. So it's time to wrap up. We're running out of time here, but Jess and then Eric, what are your final concise thoughts about this movie?
Okay, first of all, I need to watch it again. Like six times, because there's, you know, again, I'm going to come back to Joaquin Phoenix's performance. It is stellar. I've not seen him in a lot of movies lately. And like I mentioned earlier, he's one of my favorite actors, and I never felt let down by him before, because he can take on different roles. And this is definitely one of those roles. So even if you're not into superhero movies like Eric, and even if you don't care, or maybe you're a Marvel boy and you hate DC, doesn't matter. This is a great movie, and it's going to hit you from a couple different angles, which makes it, as you witnessed earlier, kind of hard to grade on the same level as other movies, because there's just so many different things going on. And yeah, if you like the Joker, this, I think, oh, wait, we can't end yet. We can't end yet. We have another topic to discuss.
Yay! Well,
yeah, what I call it before, the Joker fight, Joker quest, I called it something. The
Battle of the Jokers. Oh, so you want to rate Jokers, right, and see
Jess.
What's your favorite Joker?
I'm just, block that. Will, Captain, who is your favorite Joker and why?
I mean, it's tough because A, there's so many Jokers in the comics, and B, there's so many Jokers in the movies, and each movie is stylistically different.
Okay, well, let's just go live action movies.
If I had to rank them, I would probably put Heath Ledger's Joker at the top.
Mm-hmm.
And then this Joker, Joaquin Phoenix's Joker, in number two. And then Jack Nicholson at number three. I love
Joaquin
them all, though. I really love them all.
Can we just refer to Joaquin Phoenix as Quinoa from now on?
I mean, I'm not going to stop you from doing it. I physically can't. But I don't think that I'm going to do that. Okay, what about you guys?
Eric?
Well, you said live action movies. Now I can't pick my favorite. It's Mark Hamill,
tough.
Dude.
Oh,
okay. Mark Hamill's still playing the Joker for almost 30 years. He's been playing the Joker, and he's fucking amazing at it.
Okay.
Yeah, he's a good Joker.
You know, but so
what did you get exactly from the animated Joker voiced by Mark Hamill that you did not get from Val Kilmer, George Clooney, Heath Ledger, Michael, what was the first Batman?
Michael Keaton.
Not Adam West.
Speaking. Well, he's not even cinematically the first Batman, but you're talking about 1989 Batman. That was Michael Keaton.
Michael Keaton. Yeah, so what did you get from the animated Joker, or Batman, I should say? Yeah, animated Joker, that you didn't get from the...
It's because I think out of all the Jokers that I've seen, he's the one who just loves who he is the most. And he, and his whole philosophy is, fuck it.
Okay.
I'm going to fuck this shit up, and I'm going to have a blast, and I don't give a fuck what you people think. Because I think this is great.
Here's a follow-up question. Which of the live-action Jokers would you say is the closest to, or who could become the animated Joker voiced by Mark Hamill? Which one?
Definitely Heath Ledger came the closest to that,
okay.
I would say. Because nice. He was the guy that's just... Again, like the Mark Hamill Joker, you know, he's the guy that just loves chaos.
Right.
To the point that he's disappointed that he doesn't get killed at the end because he thought.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. What about you, Jess?
Oh, man. I think Heath Ledger has to take it. I think as far as the classic Joker we've seen in all the different incarnations, Heath Ledger does put on a performance that so far, in my opinion, has yet to be topped, because that was like his pinnacle, and it's really sad that Heath Ledger died, because just imagine where we would be today after, I don't know, three or four more movies of Heath Ledger as the Joker. And I think Joaquin Phoenix did a fantastic job, but it's a different Joker. It's a different Joker. I can't really...
Oh, absolutely. They're all different Jokers. That's why, for me, it's so hard to rank them or say who's the favorite, because I think they're all stellar.
Yeah, but I think obviously Joaquin Phoenix is the most realistic. This is the one that could be growing three houses down from you. This is the one that could be on the news tonight. I don't think I would see Heath Ledger's Joker on the TV in Detroit. But yeah, there's just so many different levels to this movie. But I would say definitely second would have to be Joaquin Phoenix. And they're almost kind of neck and neck. They're neck and neck for first place, in my opinion.
Okay, great. Well, Eric, what are your final thoughts about Joker?
I mean, I think one of the things that unsettled me most about this movie was while I felt such pity and compassion, you know, for the character of Arthur, I was at the same time very horrified and revolted by, you know, the things he started to do in the later points of the movie. But I never lost that feeling of compassion because I knew where it started. Even if right. You know, his actions.
Well, because you could relate to it.
Yeah, I could relate to it even if I vehemently disagreed with where he took it.
Right.
And I think that's one of the things that, you know, unsettles a lot of people because it's such a gray movie.
Mm-hmm.
It is a very mm-hmm. gray movie. And I think, you know, people would like to think that things are clear cut, simple and black and white. And here's a movie that is complicated, that shows a character who is not an inherently horrible person, who goes to mm-hmm. such a dark place that he does horrible things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a very uncomfortable thing. It's something that has been, you know, that has been the philosophy of a lot of the greatest films in the history of Hollywood, such as, you know, Taxi Driver, where Bickle is not a bad person, but he's dangerously disturbed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, Arthur's character in this movie. And I'm going to say this to people who may be like me, who are not exactly wild about the superhero genre. Even if you do not give two shits about Batman or, you know, the world, see this movie, because this movie proves that a movie like Taxi Driver can not only still get made and put out by a major studio, but people will still see it. And even without the Joker label, this would still be a very compelling character study.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I definitely agree with that. So my final thoughts on this is, I mean, I agree with a lot of what you guys are saying. I think that the fact that this movie is so gray and that it does make us uncomfortable in these ways that we've gone into at length is something that has made this movie such a wellspring of conversation. I mean, there's so much to discuss and think about, which is not something that I would have attributed to, like, a comic book, you know, movie that grows out of, like, a superhero universe, right? And that is one of the more interesting things about this movie to me. Again, yeah, if you are not, you know, a fan of superhero movies, this is still a movie that you would probably enjoy because it is basically a dark, psychological drama, but it just so happens to be it so happens to feature kind of a version of the genesis of the Joker, one of the most iconic, you know, supervillains of all time, and it does it in a really interesting and fresh way, I think, at least cinematically speaking.
And it's also super timely with, you know, the headlines we're all seeing in the news and on Facebook.
It feels timely.
Else.
It really does.
It's like,
does.
This is what's going on in the world today. This is what's at the forefront. You know, mental health is huge these days. And this movie, even though it's set 35 years ago, 40 years ago, it's really nailing it as far as, you know, current events. And really putting it in a capsule that can be, you know, swallowed by people. And that's the thing, like you mentioned, it's like you have to come to terms with the movie in a different way than other movies. Like when you watch Avengers Endgame, it's like there was a lot of stuff going on, a lot of emotions and this and that. And it's like, wow, I gotta digest that. You digest Avengers Endgame. With a movie like this, you have to think about it and try and find a way to understand it. You know what I mean?
Well, unlike, you know, an Avengers movie, for example, it doesn't structure the story in such a way that you come out of the movie feeling, like, great and triumphant. Like,
oh, no.
You know, you come out of the movie feeling really uncomfortable for all these different reasons that we mentioned. And I think
right.
that's one of the movie's great strengths.
Yeah.
So
that's why I asked you earlier, it's like what it made you feel, because that's the whole
right.
point. in cinemas make you feel something. And this movie makes a lot of different people feel a lot of different things. And that's why you have to really come to terms with understanding your approach to this movie before.
Well, that's why I think that people will still be talking about this movie for years to come. Honestly.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
You know, I don't know that it's going to win any Oscars or anything, but I think it should be at least nominated for some awards. But you know, with all that said,
I'm gonna add to that by saying the only reason this movie might not get nominated is because it's labeled the Joker. If you took out that title and just had it be about, you know, a guy working for a clown agency who ends up losing it, I think there would be Oscars out the wazoo.
I totally agree.
But the fact that it has the Joker label, because the Academy still has a bias when it comes to genre films.
You're absolutely right about that, Eric. So I'd be really curious to see what the nominations look like this time around. So with all that said, I just want to thank you, Eric, for coming back on the show to talk about Joker with us. And naturally, I want to thank anybody who's listening. Thank you so much. If you have a moment, hit us up on iTunes or your favorite podcast provider and give us a 5-star rating and or review. We'd love to see those, and it really helps the show out a lot. Eric, can you tell us where we can find you online and what you're up to?
Oh, yes. Well, I write articles for Screen Hub Entertainment on WordPress with my colleagues, so definitely check out some of our material there. You won't be disappointed. And I still work for International Screenwriters Association, helping many fledgling writers hopefully, you know, better their work. So if you submit your scripts to any festivals, who knows, I might be the guy to cover your work.
Great, thanks. Jess, do you want to plug our social media for the show?
Yes, Poindexters one and all, thank you for listening. You are our favorite people, obviously, aside from ourselves. But without you, we'd be nothing. And we'd like to hear from you who your favorite Joker is and why. And after listening to this podcast, you have probably already figured out that for me, it's a George Clooney, Jared Leto battle I'm looking forward to in the future. Those are my favorites.
That's a team-up movie in the darkest timeline.
Yes, and like Captain said, you can find us on iTunes, you can find us on Spotify, we're on Google Play, Anchor, CastBox, Stitcher, anywhere you listen to podcasts. We are also on Facebook as Mecha Dragon, Twitter, Instagram as Mecha Dragon Show, and shoot us an email at mechadragonshow@gmail.com with anything you want to tell us about anything at all. And once again, thanks for listening. We love you guys. Have a good night. Peace out.
Thanks again, everybody. Take care. Our music is Overworld by Kevin MacLeod from Incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0, creativecommons.org/licenses/by/3.0.